final appeal that we argued this morning is docket number 23-1087. Alisut DSAC Handling Service Air 2 Scarl versus United States.
Shorten that as Al Gacy, Your Honor.
Al Gacy. Okay, we'll work with Al Gacy. Thank you. Ms. Ittick?
Yes.
Please begin whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm Kristen Ittig from Arnold & Porter. With my colleagues, we represent the appellant here, Al Gacy. Al Gacy is an Italian contractor that provides airport operations and ground handling support for commercial and government operations all over Europe, including support for the Navy for the last 40 years in Italy. This case relates to the procurement of that operational support for the Navy's air station in Naples, Italy. In this procurement, the Navy chose a different contractor, not Al Gacy. They chose a company called Louis Berger to be the successor contractor. Our court challenge to the Navy's decision raised a large range of bid protest grounds, but our appeal only brings four of those grounds to you today. As we looked at the grounds that are before the court, the primary issue that we'd like to focus on relates to a DFARS clause, the Defense Acquisition Regulation Supplement, which governs all Department of Defense procurements. And this clause requires that contractors who are working overseas have to observe local labor laws. And this is a clause that makes sense, right? The Navy is using Italian land adjacent to the to an Italian commercial airport. There are status of forces agreements. There are NATO agreements. There are all sorts of issues that say we need to make sure that we're treating the local labor force in this situation properly. And so there's a DFARS clause that says you've got to comply with all local labor laws. So in selecting the contractor for the Naples work, the Navy was looking at the prospective contractors who have to perform.
The DFARS clause, though, does not say what happens if you don't comply with all local labor laws. And in particular, it doesn't say you are now disqualified from even being considered for an award, does it?
You're correct, Your Honor. The clause does not have that provision. The clause just says you must comply with the local labor laws. It does not specify a penalty. It's not an automatic debarment that says you can't contract.
So what is unreasonable or arbitrary or capricious about how the agency here interpreted and applied that DFARS provision?
Right. So the problem with how the agency applied the DFARS provision, Your Honor, is at first they said that they didn't even really look at the issues about previous labor law compliance. And then when they went back and they looked at labor law compliance, they had a Spanish, a member of the Spanish labor bar who was part of the Navy team. He looked at the allegations and looked at the labor law performance of the company in Spain and said, these are kind of routine. They're not really a big deal. You know, some people got terminated, some people, but most of the time, Louis Berger won the cases and just had to pay people some back wages. And that is the problem here, Your Honor, because the Navy deciding that doesn't really matter, we don't really care about this, they were misinterpreting the law. And the court should have held the Navy to a higher standard. The court should have said, Navy, you need to make you made the wrong legal interpretation here. When you said that this clause is not important, it's just routine, that was the Navy's decision on a matter of law.
So they should have read into the provision a sort of death penalty for as soon as you're found to have one violation in Spain, you can't have the contract?
No, Your Honor. We're not advocating for any sort of death penalty because there are labor law violations that will come up. But when the Navy decided as a matter of law that the clause was not important, that they didn't care about whether a contractor complied with it, they basically read that clause out of existence. And so they had to take into consideration.
Did they really go that far? Didn't they take the time to look carefully over the past history and the issues where there were labor disputes and analyze, well, some of them were valid, some of them were not valid, and give an assessment in context of what in the big picture that means? And what was wrong with that?
So, Your Honor, they did that assessment, first of all, in the heat of litigation. when they were in the midst of litigation, and they only did it on remand when the matter went back to the Navy for another set of considerations.
I understand, but nonetheless, they did consider it.
They did consider it, but they had the wrong legal interpretation, Your Honor. They started with the legal conclusion that the clause was not important to this matter. And so when they made a legal conclusion, that legal conclusion was not entitled to any deference from the Court of Federal Claims.
Well, if that was the case, then why did they take the time and trouble to go through and analyze this if it didn't matter?
Your Honor, they went through a process to say, we've looked at all of this, we've decided that it doesn't matter, so that they could paper the record and say, we've looked at this issue. But looking at the factual issue is one thing, and if this were a factual issue, they would be accorded some deference, but this was a legal interpretation that the Navy contracting officer was making.
I guess when we look at the contracting officer remand decision, I mean, I think I see two different things going on here. One is, apparently, they didn't believe that there was any violation of the DFARS provision. But then I see the contracting officer going further and saying, even if it's DFAR, this particular DFARS provision would be interpreted to mean that losing a few cases would be considered a breach of the contract, the contracting officer is going to go beyond that and then consider the context and significance of these losses, of these breaches, to try to figure out to what extent would it affect the contracting officer's view of the past performance and responsibility determination factors in trying to assess whether this bidder is capable of performing this contract in Naples. And then the contracting officer says, you know, after I consider all the context and everything, I don't think these particular defeats in these labor law cases rise to the level of something so serious that it jars the contracting officer's confidence. And once we get to that question, the actual question about the contracting officer's determination on past performance and things like that, that's something that the courts give heavy deference to. So I don't see at this moment how we can disrupt that finding, that conclusion about past performance, after taking all of this into consideration, and also even considering the theory that this would be a DFARS violation for every labor case loss.
Your Honor, part of the issue here is that in making the determination, the contracting officer was making a legal determination about what the DFARS clause meant. So the contracting officer wasn't just looking at...
I understand that piece of your argument, but yes. I never saw you respond to, I think, which is the both red briefs position that the contracting officer also made essentially an alternative holding. And that alternative holding is at A31010, where the contracting officer said, even if the DFARS provision should be interpreted in this particular way that you want it, when the contracting officer goes further and considers these particular breaches of the DFARS, it doesn't amount to something enough to shake their confidence about this person's performance.
Right, but that's a legal finding, Your Honor. It's not a factual finding.
Part is the legal finding?
A legal finding in determining what does the solicitation require. That's a legal finding. And what does the DFARS clause require? That's a legal finding. And what the
contract... Right, but didn't the contracting officer kind of give in to your theory in at least alternatively, in accepting your theory that not complying with a particular labor law due to getting an adverse judgment in the labor courts could be a violation of DFARS, but nevertheless, that violation of DFARS doesn't get you all the way to where you want to be.
Right, but that was not something that the contracting officer had the authority to do. The DFARS regulation says you've got to take this into account, and the contracting officer, in saying, you know what, I don't really mind about these, I don't really care, it's just paying people back wages, was making a legal determination, and that was beyond the authority of the contracting officer to do. The contracting officer...
Now I'm lost, because I'm not sure what you expected the contracting officer to do at that point if the contracting officer accepted the legal theory that adverse labor court judgments amount to a DFARS violation.
Right. So the DFARS clause, Your Honor, should mean the same thing whenever it's applied. Right? So a contracting officer in Italy shouldn't be able to say, I'm not really worried about this, whereas a contracting officer in Iraq says, I'm worried about this and what happens to with local labor law in Iraq. So we need a legal examination of what the DFARS clause requires, and that cannot happen from the contracting officer. So the contracting officer made her judgment, but then the court was to review that, and the court was to review that without deference to the contracting officer's interpretation of that. We owe this heavy deference when there are fact decisions that a contracting officer makes. If a contracting officer says, is that Humvee going to go faster than that one, or is that radar going to go better than another? That's a factual decision that the contracting officer...
Can I just try 31010? The contracting officer says, after reconsidering all of this, I continue to have substantial confidence in Louis Berger's ability to perform the requirements of the contract and affirm the original past performance rating and responsibility determination.
Right.
Isn't that a factual finding?
It's not, Your Honor. It's a legal determination. And the court needed to review that legal determination and did not. The court simply adopted the contracting officer's finding as its own and said, we're going to provide deference to that.
So, just so for my own clarity, what is it that you expected the claims court to have done in the face of this alternative ruling by the contracting officer? Even that accepted your interpretation of the DFARS provision?
Right. We expected the judge to make his own legal determination of whether that was a correct legal judgment that was made by the contracting officer, and the court did not. The court afforded deference to the contracting officer's decision and said, there's heavy deference, we're not going to look at this, we're going to accept it. The court didn't do what it was supposed to do. It overly deferred, and it should have undertaken its own analysis.
I guess I'm still lost because I feel like why couldn't we on review say this interpretation question doesn't matter because the contracting officer looked at these labor cases either way. Either it complies with DFARS still or it does not comply with DFARS. And in either event, in the contracting officer's view, it doesn't affect her view on the confidence of LBAS's ability to perform the contract.
Right. The contracting officer's determination was made based on an internal legal determination that a Navy lawyer made. So it was all based on the legal standards, and the interpretation of the legal standards was incorrect. So the court needed to go ahead and make its own review of that to look at the analysis. The court also erred in that it did not take into account all of the information about the labor law violations. When the Navy made its conclusion and said, it's okay, it's just standard stuff, there was a lot of other information that should have been part of the Navy's decision. We asked that on remand that be part of it. We were denied there, and then we asked that the record be supplemented with additional information about the seriousness of the labor law regulations. The court did not rule on that while the case was pending and only ruled on it after we had already appealed to the Federal Circuit, so never actually ruled on it when it was alive. Issue. There are a number of appeal grounds
before
here.
Before you filed your notice of appeal, did you go back to the claims court and say, oh, excuse me, judge, you overlooked our motion when you issued the final judgment?
And we asked the court to stay the decision pending further action, but they did not.
So you did ask the claims court to rule on your motion to supplement the record?
I need to confirm.
After the decision issued?
Am I correct on that? We'd have to look at our pleadings to be sure,
That's
Your Honor, because I don't want to misrepresent anything.
What's the current situation with the Naples contract? Is LBAS performing it now, or are you performing it?
They are. LBAS is performing the contract.
Okay. All right. It's time to hear from the other side.
Thank you.
Ms. Fleming?
Good morning, Your Honor.
You're government counsel, right?
I am.
Okay.
And today, I'd like to make three points immediately, which is that Al-Ghezi is proposing that the court first impose evaluation criteria that were not in the solicitation. Second, find a violation of the DFARS clause that does not govern procurement at all, but instead is a matter of contract administration. And finally, it's asking that the court reweigh the facts that the Navy considered and relied upon in evaluating the awardee's past performance, responsibility, and staffing criteria. On the first issue, an important point that Al-Ghezi has consistently failed to address in its briefs and its argument today is that the solicitation did not identify DFARS 252.222-7002 as a factor that was supposed to be used in the evaluation of the criteria for award in this case. There are only really two ways that this provision comes up at all. The first is the ROTA contract that Louis Berger listed as one of its past performance examples did include the DFARS clause as part of the contract, as well as many, many other contracts. And secondly, the solicitation mentioned that the future contract that would come out of this award would include the same term.
What if there, assuming there were very, very serious, willful, malicious violations of Spanish labor laws, are you saying those are not relevant to the procurement process?
They could be relevant if they impacted the performance of the contractor under its past performance. So, for example,
I mean, if there was a huge employer-employee breakdown and there was a massive strike, I mean, wouldn't all these sorts of things be relevant to trying to understand whether a particular bidder is capable of performance?
In fact, there was a massive strike in one of Louis Berger's contract performances, and the Navy specifically looked at that both before the litigation.
My point is I'm trying to make sure I understand the government's view, mm-hmm. is that you're not suggesting that it's entirely appropriate and correct for the contracting officer to turn her blind eye to massive labor problems in the performance of a different prior contract.
Well, in fact, the solicitation helps us answer this question because it provides a standard.
Well, just give me an answer to my question. You're not suggesting that the contracting officer should turn a blind eye to all of this terrible labor unrest.
If there was labor unrest that affected the quality of the performance of the contract under the terms, under the examples it listed in their past performance offering, then yes. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why the Navy considered it here. Likewise, if there was such an egregious breach of law or civility that it amounted to an ethical violation, it's possible that under the responsibility determination, the contracting officer could have considered that fact as well. So yes, there are paths to considering those facts. In this case, the Navy took those paths, made that consideration, and determined that to the extent that there was labor unrest, to the extent that there was labor litigation in the Spanish courts, those facts were not sufficiently weighty to reduce the rating that the contracting officer assigned to Louis Berger's performance. And in particular, the Navy actually considered adding an evaluation criteria of labor relations in the solicitation and ultimately elected not to do so. The Navy decided that they didn't think that it was important to independently evaluate labor relations because, again, to the extent that those relations are impacting performance, it would be part of the past performance evaluation. The clause itself, however, is also instructive. Al-Ghezi has, at every step of this litigation, focused on only the first provision in some part of DFARS 252. Those first provisions do indeed, as we have conceded, say that the contractor shall comply with local laws, regulations, and labor union agreements, etc. But there are two other subparts to that provision. Subpart B talks about indemnifying the contractor's obligation to handle and settle without cost to the United States government any claims or litigation. If you lose a case involving a foreign labor law violation, this provision tells you what will happen. It doesn't say that it will debar you from future contracts with the government. It doesn't say that you must be immediately rescinded the contract award. Rather, it provides a way to handle the costs associated with those claims and doesn't separately require any sort of penalty to the contractor. Likewise, even further, subsection C talks specifically about circumstances where a violation of a foreign law, labor law or otherwise, might actually be in conflict with a duty or obligation the contractor has under the contract. It says that the contractor will be reimbursed for costs of all fines, penalties, and reasonable litigation expenses incurred as a result of compliance with specific contract terms. So this provision read as a whole actually doesn't just say any violation of local laws is the end of the analysis. Rather, it says there may be violations of the local laws, and there should be a mechanism for reimbursement if appropriate. And in fact, we may require you to violate local laws just because of the operation of the contract. This provision is not a procurement regulation. It is a contract administration provision. And that's why it designs this system for handling issues that may arise during the performance of the contract. The Navy, like many other of the services and other federal agencies, operate across the globe. And there are lots of different kinds of, quote, local laws that exist in many other countries that we work in that are inconsistent with obligations contractors may have under U.S. law. I mean, even if you just look at employment laws, you know, typically an employer in the United States cannot violate, cannot make decisions on employment based on race or gender or religion. But there are countries in which the Navy operates where local laws require you to make decisions based in part on some of those criteria. So it's easy to understand why the Navy wanted the flexibility to say to contractors, yes, you should obey the local laws when you can, but if you don't or you can't, there's a way to address that. None of the ways that this section addresses those issues include any impact on procurement or
award. In any event, the contracting officer on remand did in fact consider this DFARS provision and concluded, at least in the alternative, that even if these adverse judgments could be considered breaches of the contract or violations of the DFARS provision, that alone isn't going to ultimately sway her view about this particular bidder's past performance rating. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. In fact, the Navy went to great lengths to try to look into some of these allegations the protester had raised during the GAO phase of the protest. And even though they had considered Lewis Berger's past performance in the context of some strikes that had occurred at its facilities and found that those strikes did not impact contract performance, because Al-Jizi raised the issue of Spanish court cases in the GAO, the Navy, out of an abundance of caution, took the time to look into those allegations, used its own expert. It didn't rely on expert offered by Louis Berger or by Al-Jizi, but used its own expert who had experience with Spanish labor law to look into the allegations and see what was there.
Before you go, what to do about this pesky motion to supplement the record that maybe the claims court tried to make a ruling on after the claims court lost jurisdiction of the case? And so I'm not entirely certain that that's appropriate for us to assume that there was a legitimate ruling on the record for that motion to supplement.
At the first instance, there was a motion under 60B pending by Al-Jizi at the time that the court decided, registered in the record a clear decision that the motion supplement was not going to be granted. So it hadn't entirely let go of jurisdiction of the case, still considering the merits as Al-Jizi was submitting them. But even if it wasn't, Al-Jizi can't identify any harm that would come out of the failure to properly rule on the motion to supplement. Everything that Al-Jizi wanted to submit is just includes facts that already were before the agency to some extent. And there's no evidence, and they've made no showing, that the Navy would have made a different decision if it had the incremental additional facts that Al-Jizi wanted to submit in its declaration, which, by the way, was prepared 3 months after the remand concluded, so clearly wasn't timely.
And there's a pretty strong rule against adding evidence into the record after the agency's issued its final decision, right?
Yes, Your Honor. The ability to supplement the record certainly shouldn't follow the court's decision, or rather the end of the remand, because the court is properly reviewing the agency's administrative record in existence at the time it made a decision, not the record made by the reviewing court or supplemented by whatever evidence that the protester appears to think is relevant.
Are you, the timing here is curious to me. Was the 60B motion pending in the trial court at the same time briefing was ongoing here in the appellate court?
I believe the timing was that Al-Jizi had filed their notice of appeal, and they filed a motion to stay on appeal, and at the same time filed their motion for relief under 60B. Do I have that correct, Kristen?
Could both courts have jurisdiction at the same time?
I view the 60B as akin to a motion for consideration, albeit not terribly timely. So, you know, I think certainly
implies maybe we didn't have appellate jurisdiction at that time.
I think that that is a reasonable interpretation.
Thank you.
Yeah. Very good. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay.
May it please the court, counsel for Elbas, Lewis Berger. This case is about the deference owed to a contracting officer's past performance and responsibility.
Do we have jurisdiction to hear this appeal?
Yes, you have jurisdiction. They filed their notice of appeal after a judgment was entered, and this court therefore has jurisdiction.
Does the Rule 60B motion that was filed below somehow disrupt that?
Regardless if it disrupted that, the case has now been, that decision was then issued and the case was resolved.
Hmm. Okay.
So I think the government covered quite extensively that, you know, there was no 7000, the DFAR 7002 clause was not included in the evaluation criteria. And even though it was not, and the contracting officer did not have to review compliance with local labor law, she still went back, brought in a lawyer from her department and her Office of General Counsel to review the cases that Al-Ghazi identified, found that even under Al-Ghazi's...
Al-Ghazi suggests that
yes,
your client's allegedly repeated violations of foreign labor laws allows you to be a lower cost bidder than those companies that make a better effort to comply with local laws. Is there evidence of that in the record, and should we be concerned with that?
So the issue here was that the Navy and the ROTA contract had actually reduced its requirements, which required us to therefore reduce the number of employees that we had on the airfield because not as many were required. So because of the reduced requirements, we were able to quote a lower price and correspondingly we didn't need as many employees. And if you see in the record, and according to the Navy's own legal expert, Elbas won the vast majority of the cases that were brought against it in the Spanish courts. The way Spain operates is that the courts act as almost a dispute resolution tribunal between the employees and the employers whenever a termination occurs, because Spain is not an at-will country. Employees are generally entitled to a certain level of severance once their positions are terminated. And here, what happens is, under Spanish law, an employee can go to the court if they're terminated for economic reasons, ask the court to verify the stated reason that they were terminated, and if the court does, they're entitled to a standard level of severance, 20 days per year worked. If the court can't verify, the employee can request enhanced severance, 33 days per year worked. So the courts operate as this function that determines whether they're entitled to a normal amount of severance or an enhanced amount of severance based off of the stated reasons. And this is all built into Spanish law and how the system operates. The contracting officer reviewed these underlying facts when she reviewed that the report prepared by her Navy attorney and found that they did not disrupt her award decision and reaffirmed her award decision. We believe that that decision is owed substantial deference by this court and that the court should affirm the lower court's decision.
Your client's been handling the air terminal and ground services in Naples?
Yes.
For how long?
For over a year now.
Any labor unrest?
No, they were able to resolve everything within a week in terms of negotiating with the new with the union.
In Naples?
In Naples.
Okay. Thanks.
Let's give Ms. Yiddick 3 minutes, okay?
Thank you.
I have to figure out where to start here. Your Honors, the labor violations that Leuenberger has engaged in are not just about severance and about paying a minor amount of severance. These are labor violations that are about undermining union activity, about spying on employees, and other very serious things. So please do not be persuaded that these are only routine labor violations. There are serious labor law violations happening in Rota, and they are such that the Spanish government declared that that Leuenberger was non grata. So there are serious violations
that
happening
there.
That
was some local authority, right? That's not
yes.
The actual Spanish government that has the power to authorize or deauthorize a contractor.
Right. And on that point, Your Honor, one of the things that the government has pointed out is that the Spanish government didn't say Leuenberger can't operate here. The Spanish government actually didn't have the authority to do that in this situation. They were only looking at Spanish military contracts and not at U.S. government contracts. So there was not, there should be no imprimatur of good housekeeping seal of approval from the Spanish government. There was no such thing that happened here. In addition, you asked about the labor situation in Naples since Leuenberger has been performing for the last year. And there are remarkably few labor issues right now because our client, Algesi, took care of a lot of those by hiring the employees. And the Spanish or the Italian government is paying the severance of the employees who were let go for 3 years. After 3 years, I don't know what happens because they are only the Italian government is taking that on. And what is happening here through this this process is this Navy contracting shop has said, we don't really care about this, it's going to be fine, we can have this job done, and we can have it done for a lot less. They can have it done for a lot less because the employees are being paid less and employees are being terminated. So that's the reason that
any evidence of that in our record?
It's in the record that we put before the Court of Federal Claims that doesn't seem to have been taken into account. The newest Naples thing obviously is not Judge Stark because it's just the latest update from this week when I inquired of our client what the status was. But this is all about the Navy contracting shop and one contracting shop saying this is what this clause means to us and this is how we're going to interpret it. And of course that's their view, right? They get something that is less expensive and they don't really care about what the impact is on the United States' relations with the host countries that host our air bases because we have these NATO agreements, these status of forces agreements, we have this clause because we have said as a country, this is important. We care about this. These guys don't really care about it, but we as a country do. And that's why you can't let one contracting officer decide, this is how we're going to interpret this clause. I'm going to make this legal interpretation that says this isn't really important because it's not their role. If DOD writ large were to make that decision, maybe that's something we'd need to look at. But DOD writ large in the DFARS has said this is what the requirement is. We should not allow a single contracting shop to act in contravention to those policies and to speak for all of DOD on this. They do not speak for all of DOD. They don't. If this is not the level where you would give a deference to someone who is at a high level of an agency and speaks for the entire agency. This is one contracting officer speaking for that contracting shop.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank
you. The case is submitted.
Thank you.
And that concludes today's oral argument.